United States v. Thompson. Appellant prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Tom Travers, and along with my co-counsel, Major Kyle Sprague, we represent the appellant in this case, Sergeant First Class Jesse Thompson. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The government had constructive possession of DS's written timeline because Special Agent TM consciously declined to preserve the statement after he confirmed DS brought it to the interview.
Is there any case authority for the proposition that constructive possession is enough?
Yes, Your Honor. I know it's not binding on this court, but the Army Court in Brooks.
Is there any authority at this level?
No, Your Honor, but there's also no authority that explicitly prohibits constructive possession from being.
Well, that's not the question.
Yes, Your Honor, and if this court held that constructive possession was not or could not lead to a Jenks Act or RCM 914 violation, then this court would go against its own reasoning in Mowakal, where this court held that allowing the government to claim they never possessed it would allow the government to avoid the consequences of RCM 914's clear language and intent simply by failing to take adequate steps to preserve statements.
Captain Travers, I'm glad you're beginning with the possession issue because I think that's the real issue in this case. But let me ask you this. Aren't the constructive possession cases that you come across these days, either in our jurisdiction or beyond, aren't there situations where, for instance, the evidence came into possession of some other entity within the government, say maybe the FBI or someone like that, and the claim is that the government doesn't possess it, but in fact they do possess it if they're military investigators. Isn't that kind of the usual constructive possession situation?
Certainly those were the facts in Brooks, Your Honor, but the factors that are the framework that that Brooks laid out provides a very workable framework for this court to apply to this case. And in fact, the fact that the facts are so different, but the test still works, is a sign of that it is, in fact, a good test, Your Honor. The first of those factors is whether the party with knowledge of the information is acting on the government's behalf or under its control. And here we have an Army special agent assigned to collect DS's statement in Army CID headquarters on Fort Bragg collecting a statement. So that first factor clearly.
But your version of the constructive possession doctrine, so to speak, seems to suggest that the government is required to take possession of certain evidence. And in this case, I think the issue is, well, he didn't need it, so why did he need to collect it, according to the agent, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly that.
So it seems like under your view of this concept, you would require the government to take possession of certain kinds of evidence, or every kind of evidence, that could later be determined to be a statement.
Certainly there's no requirement for the government to investigate a certain way or take a long affirmative steps in order to run anything to ground, but that's not what we have in this case, Your Honor. What we have in this case is a alleged victim witness standing in front of an Army CID agent saying, I have this statement right here. All he has to do is collect it. This isn't like a lot of.
But he also can ignore it. Why is he required to collect it?
Based on this court's reasoning in Mowakal, Your Honor, that allowing the government to avoid the collection of this statement and allow them to bury their head in the sand would allow them to avoid the consequences of RCM 914's clear language intent by simply failing to preserve a statement that was in the same room as them and readily offered at that time.
But that would run contradictory to other cases where we say the government is not required to create evidence that could be used.
Yes, Your Honor.
When a concept of a Jenks Act or a 914 issue, to create a statement.
Yes, Your Honor. The declination to create statements generally arises in discovery or 703 type cases, which are separate and apart from RCM 914. And in this case, nobody is asking the government to create this statement. In fact, DS had already created it, carried it with her in her pocket into the interview room.
But doesn't that put the assumption that it is a statement before the possession?
It does not put it before the possession, Your Honor. They're just two separate prongs. And it is a statement in this case, both in light of this court's expansive definition of the word statement that this court wrote about just last term in Clark, as well as the fact that even if the military judge is correct at trial, that this was just notes to recollection, as he said, citing Carrasco. Carrasco actually stands for a different principle, which is that once those notes are offered to another person, they become a statement, which is exactly what we have here.
I guess I'm still having trouble with this notion that the government must collect. They must accept this statement, assuming it's a statement.
Because it's different than a situation like in Youngblood, Your Honor, where there was some physical evidence that maybe could have been sent out for more testing and maybe that could have led to exculpatory evidence. It is not nearly so far afield in this case when the statement was already done that would require no additional affirmative steps from law enforcement other than saying, yes, I will collect that statement, and then putting it in the case file.
But Captain Travis, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask one other question.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, isn't that requiring, or at least your view of this concept, requiring the investigator to make a legal determination that what you've just told me you have in your pocket is a statement? When here, in fact, we're two courts later, we're all still grappling with this issue. We're arguing about it here today, whether or not this is a statement. The government's written a brief, you've written a brief. So we can't put that onus on the investigator, can we, to make a legal determination beforehand that what you have before you is a statement, and I am therefore required to collect it from you.
Appellant is not asking the law enforcement in this case or any future case to make a legal determination. All we're asking for law enforcement to do is to uphold their duty to conduct a neutral and fair investigation and collect a statement as it's being readily offered to them. Certainly that's not a great burden on them when it is readily right in front of them. All they have to do is say thank you, put it in the file, and it goes wherever it goes.
No, my problem is that the first instance calling it a statement. In other words, you're saying there's no problem with them collecting this statement. But I'm saying, aren't you requiring them to make a legal determination that it's a statement to begin with?
No, Your Honor. We're not asking the law enforcement agent to make any determination. And the fact that he didn't collect the statement and we're still arguing about it kind of underscores the prejudice in this case, Your Honor, which is there's this statement
by... Before we go prejudice route, when it comes to this issue of whether an agent would understand that it's a statement, trying to make a legal determination and so forth, doesn't that tie in directly to the issue of good faith basis? And isn't that an off-ramp here in terms of the intersection between constructive possession and actual possession? Here the military judge said the agent acted in good faith. That's very different than Mowakal, where it was very clear based on the statements of the JAG captain who was involved, that good faith wasn't part of it. So I believe this gets to the point that Judge Sparks is raising, but through a different prism. If, in fact, an agent doesn't believe it is a statement, here the agent didn't believe it was something that was necessary, worthwhile, of an investigatory nature, then if the military judge says that that person was acting in good faith, how can the defense prevail?
Because the agent in this case, Your Honor, acted with reckless disregard to the process and his role in it, which is to conduct that neutral investigation, collecting statements. He was in that room to collect DS's statement, and she offered him an additional statement, and he refused to collect it.
And I understand your point, but for us as a court, we have to look at a good faith determination by the military judge. What do you have that's in the record that you can point to that would show us that that good faith determination by the military judge was clearly erroneous?
Based on the actual transcript of their testimony, which came in a little bit during the cross-examination of DS, but is developed more further in Defense Exhibit Alpha for identification, where Special Agent Martin says, now you said you brought some or had some notes or something written down or something like that, dates and all that kind of stuff. And DS said, yeah, I have it. Special Agent TM said, have we pretty much covered most of that already? Diaz said, yeah, we have covered the first when I first met him, but I mean, I have specific dates if you want those. I couldn't remember them off the top of my head, but if you want them, and Special Agent TM said, it's okay, showing that he knew that she had brought them. In fact, that was his own words, that she brought them to the interview, so he knew that they were there, and she readily offered them to him, and he negligently declined to collect them. And as this court stated in Clark just last term, a sufficient showing of negligence can remove the government's ability to get away with an RCM 914 violation by the good faith loss doctrine.
So is there anything else in the record when we've got the military judge saying it was done in good faith that you would point to say that it was a clearly erroneous finding?
Well, I would couch that differently, Your Honor, where the finding that it's a good faith is really a legal determination, not a factual one. So if this court holds that the agent did act with sufficient negligence, then it's really just whether the military judge took an erroneous view of the law, which he did by suggesting that there was no gross negligence in this case, which is not the standard for whether the good faith loss doctrine applies.
You raise an interesting point. So you're saying good faith is really a legal determination.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, with the judge, military judge, citing the fact that gross negligence, couldn't that be explained by the fact that the military judge seemed to be viewing this as a hybrid question in terms of it's a Brady question, too? And so he was saying no gross negligence and was done in good faith, so that it was not a situation where necessarily where the military judge thought that was the standard for a finding of bad faith.
If that's what the military judge was trying to do in this case, which appellant does not concede, then certainly if he was trying to make both a Brady determination and a 914 violation, he failed to effectively preserve the record as to what he was finding where, and therefore his ruling should get little deference from this court.
Counsel, if we were to rule for you, in future cases we might get situations where someone says, I could make a timeline for you, would you like me to do that? Or someone could call on the phone and say, I've got a timeline out of my house, I'm on the other side of post, you want to come over and pick it up. What is your definition of possession? In other words, we can't just say the government was in possession here without having a definition of possession. And I'm wondering, what would that definition be so that we can think about how it might apply to other cases? So what would you say? Why is this possession? What's the standard?
Certainly the third Brooks factor answers your question there, Your Honor, which is whether the entity charged with constructive possession has ready access to the evidence. And in this case, the evidence in question, the statement, was in the room, in the victim witness's pocket, and she readily offered it. And your hypothetical, Your Honor, where the government would have to take some additional affirmative steps, whether that be encouraging the victim to create the statement or driving across post to get it, or certainly the farther we get away from the facts that we actually have in this case of it being in the same room and readily offered, certainly that's the ready access of the third Brooks factor. Turning to prejudice, RCM 914 has an if-then trigger. If this predicate scenario arises, then the military judge shall impose one of the two prescribed remedies. The defense's request for a production of the statement that the government possessed or once possessed and the negligent loss of it is the if, and the two remedies are the then. So the lost impeachment value, which the Army Court and the military judge assessed as, or the Army Court assessed as the prejudice, cannot be the limits of the prejudice analysis of this court, and it's because it's too speculative. That's why this court just last term in Clark analyzed whether the missing disc 4 and the testimony related to it, failing to strike that was the prejudice of failing to grant the remedy. Any cases that say it's not exclusive, or they're not exclusive remedies, don't explain away the use of the word shall in the rule itself. The only real court that takes a stab at offering an alternative remedy is the Fourth Circuit in Young, which suggests that a continuance maybe could be an alternative remedy. But really that just kicks the can down the road, because if a continuance is granted, one of two things will happen. Either the government will find the statement, in which case the issue is moot, or we wind up in the exact same situation that we have here, where as soon as the predicate scenario was met, the victim witness testified, after which the defense made their motion pursuant to RCM 914 as soon as it was ripe, and the government failed and could not produce the statement. Therefore, as appellant just discussed, there's clearly sufficient negligence in this case, where the statement was in the same room as the investigator and voluntarily offered, and he simply declined to collect it. So the predicate scenario, that if side of the analysis is met, therefore appellant is entitled to one of RCM 914's prescribed remedies.
Captain Travers, it's not clear to me, or I can't remember. Could be both. But did the knowledge or the issue of the timeline, did it become known to the defense prior to trial?
Yes, Your Honor. On 4 September, defense had their first opportunity to interview DS, at which time they discovered for the first time that the timeline was in existence. They had already received a continuance on that day for the journal entries that were also discussed in the RCM 914 motion. And then on the 5th of September, they requested the discovery of the timeline. And ultimately, the government was not able to produce it. So the defense raised the RCM 914 issue at the first available opportunity after DS had testified.
Well, the government probably said, well, we don't possess it. That's why we can't give it to you. But if the defense knew the witness had this timeline, if it was still in existence, couldn't they have just procured it themselves?
Well, defense didn't learn about it until that 4 September date, Your Honor, and trial happened a month later, by which point it had already been lost.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, I have one question before you're done. So how was – we haven't talked a lot about whether or not it was a statement at all, but how was the timeline signed or otherwise adopted or approved by the witness?
Well, signing is not a requirement, Your Honor, as you noted in your definition, or otherwise adopted or approved is certainly one of the ways she can prove it. Now, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time, if I may continue.
Please answer the question.
And certainly DS, having made the timeline herself, brought it to law enforcement and readily offered it, certainly shows that she adopted and otherwise approved of it.
Just the fact that she created it and brought it, that's all it takes. Anything that a witness creates is adopted or approved by them.
Certainly when she also offers it to law enforcement as part of her official statement. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and it has to be offered. But that act of saying, I have this thing I used to prepare, do you want it? Anything that they create, a witness creates under your definition, that they then offer to the agent is therefore a statement. That's your definition?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly her saying that this is something I created to assist in the investigation, I am offering it to you, I think certainly shows that she adopted it and approved of it.
Hey, Captain, Chief Judge, can I ask just one more question?
Sure.
I thought there was some evidence that she and her mother created this timeline.
Certainly her mother assisted in it, Your Honor, but DS went into the interview room by herself, carried it with her, the timeline with her, in her pocket, and readily offered it on her own volition. So to the extent her mother had any hand in the creation of the timeline, so I think DS's actions in the interview room show that she acted independently and personally adopted and approved it.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Anthony Contrada, and along with Major Brett Kramer, I represent the government. The military judge did not abuse his discretion when he ruled on appellant's RCM 914 motion for two reasons. First, the notebook paper with jotted dates was not a statement within RCM 914. And second, it was never in the possession of the government.
Major Contrada, since we're all thrashing around on this possession issue, could you start with that one?
Certainly.
It seems to me if it's not in the possession of the government, then there's no further question to ask.
Certainly, Your Honor, and it's uncontroverted that it was never in the actual physical possession of the government. And here we're under an abuse of discretion standard, and we have a military judge who did nothing more than decline to create new law. as was discussed earlier, creative possession, firstly, is not an RCM 914 or Jenks doctrine, though we see it applied in one court, in one Army court case. However, not only is it not primarily a 914 doctrine, it also applies only to law enforcement, joint investigations. That is the case law. And this is a military judge who's simply following the law when he determines this was never in the possession of the government, and that's not an abuse of discretion. RCM 914 is about the preservation and production of statements that are in the government possession and not about the initial collection of statements. And if I could return briefly to this not being a statement, Your Honor, the notes at issue here, they were co-authored. They were made in private, and they were informal. DS didn't sign them, and they weren't adopted, and DS even testifies that the dates on this piece of paper were, quote, grabbed off her calendar, her meaning her mother's calendar. So DS says that her mother grabbed these dates off her calendar, the mother's calendar. And that's something that needs some indicia of formality. Even had law enforcement collected this piece of paper, some further adoption, some further discussion would have been necessary. And that's especially the case where it appears to have been co-authored with a parent, and I believe DS at the time was 19, but a child victim at the time of the offenses. And that's what the law enforcement agent here was trying to do. It's clear when we look at the interview that the law enforcement agent was trying to get DS's unadulterated version of events. He wasn't necessarily interested in that moment in what she had looked at on Facebook or her mom's calendar together with her mom. The agent wanted this witness's unadulterated memory of events.
Can we look at that from the other angle? If we've got someone who is creating notes, first off, the military judge, I believe I've got the statement correct, says it's not a statement because there are entries intended to transmit information or statements. Why isn't that the definition of a timeline in terms of entries intended to transmit information? That's my first question.
Well, Your Honor, I think the best characterization of the dates here, and I think this is favorable to appellant, but I think at most favorable to appellant, this would be a memory aid that was jointly authored, but a memory aid that wasn't used. Now, I think
so. But doesn't that, and it flows into my next question, doesn't that actually hurt your position? If you've got here a victim who, in working with her mother, creates a memory aid, doesn't that by its very nature indicate that, in fact, the individual viewed this as being an accurate reflection of the dates that these things occurred, and that the individual went through a selection process saying, oh, yes, this is correct, and this is correct. So by that very nature, wasn't there an adoption of this by the victim?
So firstly, Your Honor, under the facts of this case, we still have to get past the hurdle, which the government doesn't believe we can, that we don't know that it was DS herself, and in fact, every indication is it was not herself. And a statement under the Supreme Court's definition has to be the statement, the words alone of the person making the statement. And secondly, even if we look at this as a memory aid, the memory aid is not the statement itself. So I think here, if she had read the dates off of the piece of paper into what became her sworn statement to CID, that would have been her statement. But simply a memory aid, even if used, it is far from being, I think, a Jenks statement under even similar facts to this case, and certainly not in this case. And I think we can see appellant's challenge here in that we have 60 years of Jenks case law, and appellant hasn't cited, and the government's not aware of, a single case with really similar facts to this case where we have a private party victim witness with a piece of paper in their pocket that becomes a Jenks or 914 statement with nothing more. So that's why the government believes that even had the agent collected this, some further conversation or signing would have had to take place for the memory aid piece of paper to become part of the statement.
Switching to the issue of possession, what is the government's position in terms of the reasoning behind Wackel about incentivizing improperly, obviously, a government agent not to accept information, evidence that is right within his or her grasp when there's a concern that a government agent might fail to take that step because it might, in fact, be evidence that would benefit the defense?
So first, Your Honor, just to briefly distinguish Muwakil, of course, in that case, the government created and had in its possession Article 32 testimony and subsequently lost or destroyed it. Here the government didn't have it in its possession, as we've discussed. But the issue, the problem here is appellant presents this non-collection as a Jenks issue, and appellant and the defense at trial, the correct avenue here, this should be analyzed under unavailable evidence, but we can see the reason. So it's not as if appellant doesn't have an avenue, albeit in the government's understanding still a meritless discovery claim, but there is an avenue to approach uncollected evidence, evidence that was never in the possession of the government. But here we know that appellant wants the benefits of the drastic remedies of 914 without having to make the argument that it would have to in the discovery setting and show that the non-collected evidence was exculpatory or necessary for a fair trial or that there were no adequate substitutes. And those are the requirements of RCM 703. So what appellant's trying to do is understandably pick the rule that works best for them, even though it doesn't work. So there's no gap in the law here. This is simply an effective defense counsel trying to shoehorn something into 914, uncollected evidence that doesn't belong there.
I think I was at times misstating, citing to Muwakil when I meant to be citing to Stellato. So I apologize for that confusion.
And just, again, touching on it, in the good faith context, even if the military judge erred and abused his discretion in this case, appellant would still be entitled to no relief because the good faith doctrine should have applied and appellant would not have been prejudiced. Now,
and can I just ask, if the good faith doctrine applies, the government prevails?
In this case, yes, Your Honor.
And it doesn't matter about anything else. Good faith doctrine standing alone, the government can prevail in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And here we have a military judge who put that finding on the record that there was no bad faith by the CID agent and also that there was not sufficient negligence for the doctrine not to apply. And briefly, appellant described that CID agents acts as reckless, and that's just not, as the government argued a few minutes ago, there's a very reasonable explanation for what the CID agent did. He wanted to get at this child victim, albeit 19, still living with her mom at the time of the interview. He wanted to get at her memory. He wanted an unadulterated version of events as according to her and disentangle that from any influence from the mother. And that's a reasonable approach. And we also see the lack of bad faith. There's no effort to hide anything. This was all during an on-the-record interview. And the agent even asked DS questions specifically to determine where did these dates on this piece of paper come from. And so, in other words, the piece of paper itself was nothing special. It was just derivative. And
so what should we make of the military judge's cite to gross negligence?
Your Honor, there's nothing contrary to using gross negligence as the standard. Certainly, simple negligence may be within a judge's discretion, according to Muwakil. But United States versus Marsh used gross negligence, and even in Muwakil, the trial judge in that case found negligence bordering on gross negligence, or words to that effect. So this judge was well within the requirements of the case law and the good faith analysis that we find in military and federal courts. And for those reasons, pending any further questions, the government asks this court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant's first point is that this is not a 703 case. This is a 914 case. That was the objection raised at trial. That has been the appellant's argument throughout the appeals process. And just as something can be both a hearsay and a relevance issue, so too it can be both a discovery issue and an RCM 914 issue, which is the case we have here. The rules of 914 are perfectly capable of resolving this case, and this appellant is not adopting any sort of hybrid argument here, merely that this court use the rules and case law subject to RCM 914 to decide this case. Appellant's second point is that the government highlighted multiple times that this was not signed, which is not a requirement based on the rule, and the case that Campbell, the case that the government relies heavily on in its brief on pages 16 and 31, actually cites a dissenting opinion for that proposition. So to the extent that this court feels that signature is required, clearly the rule saying that or otherwise adopted or approved allows a non-signed statement to still be within the bounds of RCM 914. Thirdly, the government stated that this applies only to law enforcement or joint investigations, but that's only one prong of the analysis in the Brooks factors. And just because one factor is not applicable to resolving this question does not mean that that this court cannot weigh the first and third factors so heavily that appellant is entitled to relief based on that constructive possession. Certainly, in the case of, say, adultery and whether adultery is service discrediting, there are nine factors associated that courts may use to determine whether, in fact, it was service discrediting. Not all of them must apply in order for the certain conduct to meet those standards. Pending any further questions from the court.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess until 1300.